This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. You want your downtown to thrive? Groceries. Groceries. You got to have a place where people can pick up bread and milk and also mangoes and, I don't know, kombucha, fish sauce, whatever they want. You need a grocery store to draw people. Or wait, don't you have to have people before you can get a grocery store? That's a good question in this region of boom, and we're going to take that up in 15 minutes, so stay tuned. First, the big news story of the day, the U.S. Senate has delayed the vote on its health care bill until, they say, next week. At least six Republican senators are saying they won't vote for the bill as it's described right now, partly because of what the Congressional Budget Office said yesterday. The CBO predicted that in 10 years, 22 million more Americans would be uninsured under this Senate plan than under Obamacare. Now, if some kind of Republican health insurance bill makes it to President Trump's desk, what could it mean for health care here in Washington State? To help us figure that out, we have Aaron Katz, who teaches health policy in the University of Washington School of Public Health. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Good to see you.
Good to see you again. And Roger Stark is a retired physician and a health care analyst for the Washington Policy Center. Welcome, Roger.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Roger, what do you think of the Senate plan so far?
I think the Senate plan is very, very similar to the House plan that passed last month. I think it is a good start at correcting some of the problems that we have had, that we have seen with the Affordable Care Act. The real question, of course, is are there enough moderate Republicans, are there enough conservative Republicans who are going to get behind this and vote for it?
Roger, you say it corrects problems in the Affordable Care Act. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, says this would leave 22 million fewer people with health insurance over the next 10 years. So why is the problem correction overall a good thing?
Well, first of all, one of the main goals of the Affordable Care Act was universal health insurance. At the time it passed, there were, for one reason or another, there were about 50 million uninsured in the United States. Now, to date, the Affordable Care Act has insured about 20 million, so it's reached about 40% of its goal. If we look at that CBO number of 22, it was 23 million with the House bill. That includes somewhere between 10 to 14 million people who will lose or will not sign up for Medicaid. And that's almost hard to believe that I think the House number was at least 5 million people would not sign up for a free entitlement health insurance plan like Medicaid. So I think that number is suspect. The other goal, the second goal of the Affordable Care Act, was to bend the cost curve of health care down. Families were going to save $2,500 on average per year on their insurance premiums. And in no way have we seen the overall cost of health care go down in this country. So clearly something needs to be done.
Okay, something needs to be done. Aaron Katz, let's get into that. First, what do you think of the Senate plan? You just heard it described as better than what we have.
Well, I guess I have a different view than Dr. Stark does. As far as I can tell, none of the provisions of the Senate Republican plan actually address problems, which I agree with Dr. Stark, exist with how the Affordable Care Act was structured and how it was implemented. So Dr. Stark mentioned that the Affordable Care Act has not bent the cost curve down, that is, helped to control costs. And you know, there's some debate in the research literature about that, but I would tend to agree with him. But there's nothing in the Republican proposal that, in my understanding of the evidence, would affect healthcare costs. And the problems with insurance, which Dr. Stark identified well, certainly can be solved. We know very well how to make sure that people can afford insurance, but it would require just the opposite of what the Senate Republicans are proposing, which is to cut money out of Medicaid, reduce subsidies. And in fact, we have 30 or 40 years of experience that tells us that if you want to make insurance affordable for people, you have to increase subsidies, not decrease them.
Aaron, is it fair to say that this Senate Republican plan and the House Republican plan are tax cuts for the wealthy? Is that fair?
Well, I mean, the proposals have been characterized that way, and certainly both proposals cut nearly all of the taxes that helped to support the Affordable Care Act, and those taxes, those tax cuts, primarily benefit wealthier people and companies. So I think that's just the reality of those proposals.
Roger, agreed. Whether it's a good thing or not, tax cuts for the wealthy, is that fair?
Yeah, I think I agree with Aaron that the majority of the payments come from high earners, those who earn more than $200,000 a year. But I disagree with one thing, and that is that the taxes to fund the Affordable Care Act, actually, they affect everyone who uses health care, simply because there were taxes on insurance premiums, insurance companies, drug manufacturers, medical device manufacturers, and those increase in taxes were passed on to consumers. So anyone who is a consumer of healthcare will be paying those increases in those taxes. So I think it affects everyone in this country.
Okay, some tax cuts for the not wealthy, mostly tax cuts for the wealthy?
Yeah, I think we could probably say that, but then I mean, another way to look at this, actually, is with the increased taxation that the so-called rich are paying. I mean, that in a sense is like income redistribution, I guess we could say. So what's fair?
Right, what's fair? Aaron, let's talk about Medicaid, which Roger brought up. This Senate plan would cap federal spending on Medicaid. Do states have the option of picking up that tab? And if so, what's the big deal?
Yeah, sure. Of course, theoretically, the cuts that are in the Senate Republican proposal, which would total nearly $800 billion, it's certainly theoretically possible for states to pick up that money. But just to give you an example of the challenge that would be for states, so in about 2025, in about 8 years or so, this state, the state of Washington, would have to come up with about $2 billion a year to maintain the coverage that exists today in Medicaid. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the legislature is now in its third special session to come up with sufficient funding for K-12 education.
I have noticed that, in fact.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult task. It would require the state to come up with either to come up with new taxes itself or to cut other necessary services, for example, to cut the budgets of higher education.
Roger, what do you think of Washington State having more control over Medicaid, and what would you want Washington to do with that control?
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing. I think all healthcare basically is local, and I think states can make a much better decision about where funds should go and who should be taken care of than the federal government does. So
to figure out where healthcare should go, or do they just write a check? I really don't know how that works. Is the federal government overmanaging the system when they don't cap Medicaid spending?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's a good point. I mean, up to this point, what happens is the states spend X amount of money, and then the federal government gives the states a matching X amount of money, basically, a 50-50 sort of split, although some states pay less, some states pay a little bit more. But the real critical thing, though, is along with those dollars that come from Washington, D.C., are all kinds of regulations and rules and so forth. So, sure, the state kind of manages the Medicaid program, but it does it within the confines of the rules and regulations that are set by the federal government.
Is Aaron correct that in reality, Washington State, which is struggling to pay for basic education, is not going to cover that Medicaid gap?
Yeah, I agree with him completely on that. I mean, what happened was 1965, Medicaid passes as a government safety net, and now it is one of the top three budget items for every state in the country. I think in Washington State, it's number two behind K-12 education. So, yeah, I mean, Medicaid has exploded, and states on their own cannot make up that funding gap. Having said that, though, I think Medicaid is an out-of-control entitlement, and it does need to be reformed. And both the House and the Senate bill provide the first real entitlement reform we've seen in Medicaid since its inception 50 years ago.
Roger Stark is a retired physician, a healthcare analyst for the Washington Policy Center. We also have Aaron Katz, who teaches health policy in the University of Washington School of Public Health. Aaron, if a Republican plan of some type like the ones we've seen so far out of the House and Senate, if that were to be signed into law by President Trump, what do you predict would happen to Washington State's health exchange?
Well, what the law would do, let me actually respond to one thing that Dr. Stark said. He thinks that that states can make better decisions about health care and who receives health care, and I agree with them. And in fact, this state's a great example of the state taking initiative and plotting its own path, as Oregon has done as well. And it's quite possible under the rules that that govern Medicaid. So in fact, states are doing that now. And what the Senate Republican proposal does is say, You have the flexibility to make decisions without the funding to implement those decisions. So I think it's a false flexibility. It's a false promise. And what will happen to the exchange if you look at the Senate Republican proposal, it greatly reduces the amount of subsidies for individuals, especially for older people and people who are sicker, and they will end up facing much higher premiums and much higher deductibles. And the expectation is that fewer people will be able to afford insurance, and even those who are able to buy insurance won't be able to afford the care that's covered by that insurance.
So then, Aaron, Obamacare is struggling. The Republican plans would cover fewer people. What about universal health coverage, like in Canada or the UK?
Well, let me just correct one thing, that Obamacare is struggling. Health insurance exchanges around the country, which cover 10% or less of Americans, certainly have challenges. And we've seen that in our own state. The insurance commissioner, Mike Kreidler, has just convinced insurance companies to cover people in all counties in the state. So that's a good sign.
Yeah, Klickitat and Grays Harbor were looking like they were going to have zero insurers.
And so that the exchange has challenges, and many of those challenges are caused by the political uncertainty emanating from Washington, D.C. But the rest of Obamacare, especially the Medicaid expansion, which Dr. Stark criticizes, it's actually been a great boon for tens of millions of people who are able to get access to care that they have not had access to before. So I think the notion that Obamacare is failing is just incorrect. There are problems that need to be solved, for sure. And it would be great to see Congress attempt to solve those problems, but neither the House nor the Senate proposals do anything to solve those problems.
You know, we're getting at a question that we asked KUOW's Facebook fans: is health care a human right? And Ben said, I'd like health care to be reasonably accessible to those who want and need it, but that does not make it a right. James is in the majority on our Facebook page saying it is a right. He says, we don't demand that private citizens pay for the defense services they receive from the U.S. military beyond what they contribute in taxes. Why should health care be any different? Roger, do you think that to you, is health care a human right?
Access to health care is a right, sure. And I think that's why the government exists. Whether you believe that healthcare is a right or not, everyone can believe that it's a necessity, can agree that it's a necessity of life. And the government is there to provide a market so people can purchase these other necessities of life, like food, shelter, and clothing. And healthcare, at the end of the day, it's a very personal, but at the end of the day, it's an economic activity. And absolutely, the government should be there to provide a framework so people can, in a timely fashion, access healthcare.
Well, let's talk about that framework then. On Facebook, Camille writes, healthcare for profit makes about as much sense as police for profit. Oh, I'm really sorry you have a man outside your home trying to break in, but you don't have any safety insurance. We can't help you unless you prepay $5,000. Then we can see about helping you so you don't die today. What do you think of that analogy?
Well, I think it's a little misdirected. I think government society is there to provide certain protections, fire, police, ambulance, and so forth. But as far as healthcare is concerned, I think those people that are in your poll on your Facebook page that believe that it's a right, then they have to decide who is going to make the decision about how much money we're going to spend for it. They're going to have to make a decision, or who is going to make a decision about what kind of health care we're going to get, who is going to be able to access health care. And I would just assume have patients as consumers make those decisions rather than faceless bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. or Olympia.
Aaron, patients instead of faceless bureaucrats?
Well, we call on our elected officials to make important decisions about making sure that we have adequate education for our kids, adequate protection by police and fire in our neighborhoods. They have to make those decisions every year about how much money to spend. And if we don't like those decisions, we have recourse as voters to change the people making those decisions or influence those decisions. And I don't see how healthcare is really any different than that. And the notion that consumers will make decisions about how much money we should spend on healthcare, I just don't think that's anything related to reality. The fact is that healthcare is a very complex system. It's very complex. I mean, people like Dr. Stark were trained for 10 to 14 years to have the expertise to make decisions on our behalf as patients. And in fact, they're licensed by the state as a monopoly in being able to make those decisions because it's very complex doing so. Now, it's not to say that patients ought not have a role in their health care, but the notion that patients are somehow going to be in the driver's seat as they are in deciding what car to drive or what phone to buy is, I just don't think it reflects how the reality of people's lives.
And there we've come to a political, philosophical gulf, and let's pause it there and watch what happens in Washington, D.C. together as Senate Republican leaders have delayed a vote on their health care bill. Now I'm seeing that this is delayed until after the July 4th recess. And the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell delivered that message today at a private lunch attended by the Vice President and the White House Chief of Staff. So no health care vote in the Senate until after they break for July 4th. Let's break here with Aaron Katz and Roger Stark. Aaron teaches health policy, UW School of Public Health. Roger Stark, retired physician and a health care analyst for the Washington Policy Center. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. More in a moment. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Can you identify this sound? I'll bet you can if you live near the Port of Everett. That is where a tugboat horn blared for hours in the middle of the night on Sunday. Yesterday, neighbors got this letter from the port's CEO. We apologize for the prolonged horn noise at the port last night. One of our customers has been doing some finishing work on a new ocean-going tugboat, and the horn malfunctioned. Our customer has assured us they have remedied the issue. Please accept our sincere apologies about the noise, the time it took to figure out how to turn off the horn, and the fact that it happened on the hottest day of the year so far. That's right, it was a record-breaking 87 degrees in Everett on Sunday, so you couldn't get to sleep, and as soon as you did, Okay, that's enough of that. Now, let's talk more about noise, okay? Not the stuck horns. Let's talk about the normal noise that happens in a busy downtown. Bremerton's downtown used to be bustling like that decades ago. Now it bustles for a few minutes when the Navy shipyard lets out around 4 p.m. Other than that, it can be a little too quiet. Reporter Carolyn Adolph of KUOW's Region of Boom team says people in Bremerton think one thing could bring back the bustle.
On the Seattle side of the Sound, people and cars and buses and everything is everywhere. This is what a boomtown sounds like. On the Bremerton side, it sounds more like this. Even at 11 o'clock in the morning. Most of the shops are closed. There's hardly anyone on the street. In one shop that was open on a Monday morning, the owner announced that she was leaving Bremerton. She's moving to Silverdale, where they have a mall. Bremerton has a problem. There aren't enough people, so businesses don't do well, so more people don't come. People say the solution is not complicated.
Why don't they put a big grocery store downtown?
This is Edith Irene Hambrick, a longtime resident of Bremerton. There are a few places to get groceries in the city. Hambrick doesn't think much of any of them.
Right now, you have to go all the way to Silverdale just about to buy groceries easily. And if they'd move the grocery store down there, they wouldn't have any trouble getting people down there. That'll get the people back.
How do you create the vitality in this wonderful city that's just so ready?
This is Ron Scher. On the Seattle side, we know him as the founder of Third Place Books.
What I've been trying to do in my career is to create really livable places and places where people come together.
On the Bremerton side, they know him as the guy who wants to put a grocery store where the old Bremer department store is, smack in the middle of downtown.
Unless you have this kind of infrastructure, it doesn't make living as attractive, and it's a sense of convenience.
Right now in Bremerton, you need a car to get food. There's a Safeway a mile and a half away from the downtown, and out on the highway here, there's a huge Fred Meyer. Think how life would change if people could walk up from the ferry, grab a few things for dinner, and walk home. Scher says he'll tear down the old department store, build the grocery store, and give it parking by opening up some of the spaces that he already owns across the street.
I think the time is now.
The city is full of developers like Scher, who see Bremerton as a sensible place for our region's population to expand. They think it just needs a little love.
Creating getting that critical mass where it has the kind of energy and the eclecticism and the interest and the timelessness that will bring it together.
Bremerton has been rife with rumors that an announcement is imminent. It turns out that a grocery store is not coming soon. Ron Scher.
We haven't selected a grocery store. I still feel strongly we'll get one, but we don't have one yet.
That's because there isn't a critical mass of people. Scher says it's a chicken and egg situation.
You don't get the grocery store before the people, and the people don't necessarily go there before the grocery store.
But other developers are building apartments nearby.
As those come closer to reality, I think that then I'll go enter the market and look for a grocery store again.
Until then, Scher will be working on the chicken, or is it the egg part of the problem? He has plans to build several hundred apartments for people who will have to buy food somewhere. I'm Carolyn Adolph with KUOW's Region of Boom team.
KUOW's Region of Boom reporting team is in Bremerton this month, and you can follow all of our coverage at KUOW.org. And since we're thinking groceries now, let's roll our carts over to the baking aisle. The Great British Baking Show is a reality show, but it's different from an American reality show, and we'll tell you how in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I don't think I'm about to spoil anything for you if you're a fan of The Great British Baking Show, or as it's called in England, The Great British Bake Off. Because if you're a fan, you probably know what this person is about to say.
The winner of the 2015 Great British Bake Off is... Nadia.
Nadia. She baked 16 iced buns in 3 hours. Yes, this is obviously a reality TV show. And partly it's what you'd expect. Amateur bakers competing in wacky bread and cake-making challenges under an absurd deadline. But in other ways, the Great British Baking Show is nothing like American reality shows. For example, Salon TV critic Melanie McFarlane told Jeannie Yandel that, well, let's talk about the 2015 winner whose name you just heard, Nadia Hussein.
Nadia Hussein is Muslim. She keeps her head covered. But that was never her faith and her culture was never made a front and center part of the show, although you'd have to be blind not to notice that she's Muslim. And the great thing about it is the hosts never came over and there was never the special episode on like, and now we're going to do a little background on Nadia, who hails from Bangladesh. You know, like there was never that aspect. It was just, okay, here's Nadia. What are you baking today? You're baking this? Oh, with an orange and cardamom. Okay, that's interesting. Hope you can do that. Next. And that's the great thing about the Great British Baking Show is that everything there is very, it's about the baking. It's about the artistic process and it's about talent and that's it.
Well, as usual, Maria's looking super relaxed. She looks like she's done this 100 times before.
She knows the pastry. She knows the dough. She's used to it. It's her technique. She's not budging. Good for her.
It's such a weird show to be as popular as it is. And yet one has to watch it to understand why it's so popular.
Well, I feel the need to point out, as someone who has never seen the show, I will cop to the fact that I've never seen the show. It is a reality show. It's a competition. And it seems like, particularly here in the United States, we do have an appetite for that, right? So how is the Great British Baking Show different from the other contestant-based reality shows that we've seen, like Survivor? You know, how is it any different?
Here's the thing about American competitive reality. In our DNA, we have this huge competitive streak. And that showed up in our first reality shows. If you think about it, one of the very first reality shows that we had was The Real World. And the entire premise of The Real World, one thing that made it interesting was that you had a number of strangers together in a house. And after a while, all the pretense drops away. That's actually in the opener of the series. And people start being impolite to each other.
They start getting real.
They start getting real is what I'm saying. So there's that whole focus on tension that's within the original DNA of reality shows. There's always a contestant saying, I'm not here to make friends. There's this whole implication of conflict that is completely, or if it's absent, I'd say if it's not completely absent from the Great British Baking Show, they really go to great lengths to hide it. There's real anxiety on that show, but contestants help each other. Now, on Project Runway, there were contestants that helped each other. As people who have heard me on this show before know, I'm a huge fan of RuPaul's Drag Race. They will help each other. The contestants will help each other. And then they'll go and gripe about it later in the confessionals. And they'll say, oh, God, I had to help so-and-so, so-her, whatever. Now, there may be that on the Great British Baking Show, but you don't see it. Hmm. What you see are the contestants helping each other unmold their cakes or helping each other frost their cookies. And then when the judgment comes, they all sit together and they kind of hold each other's hands or they might hug each other. And nobody is really, there's no emphasis that is really plain to see on any kind of conflict that's kind of brutal. I mean, in the end, the winner gets a cake plate. A cake plate and some flowers. Yeah, that's it. Now, after that, they get a lot of endorsements. But that's what they're battling for, a cake plate and some flowers.
Wow.
Basically a serving dish and some flowers. Yeah.
One of the things that we were talking about before the microphones went on was you called it the casual diversity of the Great British Baking Show. What did you mean by that?
So I should preface this by saying there's really no such thing as casual diversity in reality television. It is very much sought out and conscious if and when you see it. Having said that, again, it goes back to when we're talking about Nadia Hussein's win. This particular season of the Great British Baking Show, among the contestants, we have two black contestants, and one of them is a black man, and we have a Sikh gentleman who are all part of it. But at no point is there, again, someone saying like, oh, are you making something that's, you know, maybe something should have some sort of food from your heritage in it. So there's never, when I talk about casual diversity, what I mean is that there isn't an emphasis on, hey, look, we have this incredibly diverse number of contestants, but they're also, they're all, you know, there's no, this is a person who's Sikh or black British. They're all just British. We're making British food here. We're British people making British food, full stop. That's it. Hmm. Now, contrast that with an American reality series called The Bachelorette, which took 15 years to have an African-American woman as a bachelorette. Although she has done her best not to have that be front and center in the show itself, A, you can't ignore it because of the dynamics of The Bachelorette and the way it works. And B, it became such a part of the advertising for this particular season. One of the things they did was they had a pre-show where they had the Chris Harrison, who's the host, bringing out three of the contestants who were going to be on with her. And one of them said, I'm dating black and I'm never going to go back. And it was a white guy. And I'm just kind of like, oh, dear God. No, that is not casual diversity. That's very conscious of like, yes, this, we have a black bachelorette and there's going to be white contestants on this show. And yes, we're conscious that this is an interracial dating situation that we are showing. You don't see that in the Great British Baking Show. You just see this love of baking that crosses all sorts of ethnicities and age ranges. And also, you know, both genders are equally represented. Multiple genders are equally represented.
I know you're a fan of this show, Melanie. What is there for somebody like me to gain by watching this show? I've never seen it before. I have expectations of reality shows. I think you probably could guess what my expectations are based on how shocked I was when you told me that the bakers who win don't actually win any money. That stunned me. What's the magic of that show, do you think?
The magic of that show is really depicting something that really anyone could do. And I say this as a baker, if you can follow directions, you can bake. It might not be the best thing that you've done in your life, but you can bake. And making it into raising a little level of artistry on the simplest things and then putting a time crunch on it. So I'll give you an example. When my husband first, when I turned to it, when it first premiered and my husband came in and he started laughing and saying, I can't believe we're watching this show. And I said, I'll turn. And he said, no, no. So he sat down with me and he was enthralled. And he doesn't, I mean, he cooks a little bit, but he doesn't bake at all. And so I said, what do you think? He goes, it's like 24 crossed with desserts. It is. It's 24 crossed with desserts or breads. But nobody's screaming at each other. The tension is not exacerbated by any meanness. If anything, the tension serves to augment the experience of looking at what average people can do in a time crunch. And I think, again, on a Friday night after, you know, our, I don't know about you, but I feel these days our weeks are very, very, very long. Filled with a lot of stressors outside of just what's going on in our personal lives or our work, you know, work lives, those kinds of things. And to have something that is always kind of bright and sunny, you know, everybody is doing these, they're all doing these lovely creations. Nobody's yelling. There are tears, but everybody is very supportive of each other. It's just a really nice thing to watch at the end of the week.
Melanie McFarland is a TV critic for Salon. We're tweeting out a link to her latest article about what in the UK was called the Great British Bake Off, but Pillsbury owns the Bake Off trademark in the United States, so here it's the Great British Baking Show. The most recent season has started airing on Seattle's KCTS Friday nights, and you can also catch the first three seasons on Netflix. And we are not done with food yet. We're still hungry. So let me tell you what happened in Portland last month. The owners of a pop-up burrito restaurant called Kooks gave an interview. These were two white women restaurant owners, and they said they went to Puerto Nuevo, Mexico, and tried to learn to make the delicious burritos created by the women there. But the women of Puerto Nuevo didn't share all their information, so the visitors ended up, quote, peeking into windows of every kitchen. Well, that made some Portlanders mad. They accused Kooks of cultural appropriation. And a few days later, the Kooks burrito restaurant closed. Now, this question of appropriation is an old one in the food world. When is it okay to take recipes and techniques from mostly poorer cooks and use that to make money for yourself? It's a gray area for a lot of professional chefs, including Seattle's Eduardo Jordan, chef and owner of the Solare and June Baby restaurants, and Seattle's Rachel Yang, chef and owner of Jewel, Revel, Trove, and Revelry. Here's Rachel.
We do fusion, means basically we start with Korean food and then we kind of go everywhere from there. So we have a lot of food that has basically, you know, like Middle Eastern flavor, European flavor, African flavor, Southeastern Asian flavor, you name it, we have it.
Are you stealing?
I don't think so. I'm a cook. And number one thing about being a cook is that basically you're always there to learn. You're never basically taking it your own. You're like, oh my gosh, that food is amazing. Like, how can I basically build something on that and then, you know, make it something?
Eduardo, what's your take?
I don't think we're stealing. You know, we're always learning from each other. That's why we eat out at other restaurants. That's why we travel. That's why we get new experiences so that we can bring something new to what we do from a cook standpoint. I know that I was trained in French cuisine and trained in Italian cuisine. I'm from the South. I like cooking all of that. And I show respect for the ingredients and the things that I learn. And I always pay respect to where I've learned something from.
Do you get to be unapologetic about what you do, Eduardo, because you're African-American and not white? Is it a different situation if you're a chef of color versus a white chef?
We get a little safety card.
A safety card.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's almost in a way that it's unfair to, you know, talented, like, you know, white Caucasian chef, like, you know, who are paying the homage, who are doing their due diligence, who are having the good intention of learning and exploring, and they're representing, you know, different cuisine through their food, and then they don't get to have a loud voice because people there are afraid of what people might have to say.
Is there a case where a chef is appropriating or being insensitive or ungrateful about the food they cook? Does that ever happen?
I mean, I have not experienced that. I've seen it in the news or been around anyone like that. But yeah, I think if a chef boastfully put out a cuisine that is not theirs and they don't pay homage or respect to that cuisine and say, like, I built this on my own, this is all my thought. This, I've never experienced this before, and this is mine. Like, yeah, now we need to start talking to them.
Have you ever, Rachel, been to a restaurant where somebody was serving Korean food and you just said, you don't know what you're doing and you don't seem to care?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, at the same time, everyone is, and you know, in the same token, that I get the same kind of response from people who are coming to my restaurant and like, hey, your kimchi is not what it is. And I'm like, wait, like, so you have traveled to Korea once and had kimchi once, and you're telling me this is not the kimchi that what it should be. But, like, you know, when you go to Korea, there are actually, like, a million different kinds of kimchi. There are different regional kimchi, different seasonal kimchi. So, like, even to define something to be authentic in one way, it's a very dangerous thing to kind of, like, you know, label and, you know, define. And I think the fact that, like, how do you even go further and saying, like, what is right and what is wrong? I mean, the saying that I think this is righteous, this is wrong, and I think that is really hard to even define.
Well, what about this pop-up burrito place in Portland? I mentioned it earlier. You've both heard about this. Apparently, the women who went down to Mexico, they asked questions and then peeked in some windows or something. What did you think of their use or appropriation of Mexican food?
You know, that was a tough one because I think they were doing the right things as chefs. They went, they experienced, they traveled, they learned, and they brought what they experienced back to the best of their ability to their own style. I read more on the article, and, you know, what shocked me was the fact that one of the young ladies didn't actually learn the recipe. She saw them doing it, and then she went back home and started recipe testing on her own. Like, she did that on her own. She did not, like, find a scroll from their pantry with the recipe and took a picture of it and ran away with it. She says she started testing by just seeing the techniques. She used what was in front of her as, like, experience and knowledge to help her grow. So I was kind of—
But without asking, without permission?
Well, I mean, for me, it's like, It's the same thing as watching a YouTube video. It's like you saw someone, some random tourist had a camera and they videotaped someone making tortillas. You watch that and you're like, oh, you know what? I'm going to make tortillas at home.
Do you do that? Have you taken
Yeah, I've Googled recipes because I was missing something, or I like played around. I'm like, what is this missing? And I Googled, I'm like, oh, yeah. Or I watched a video and I'm like, that makes sense. And so, yeah, we all learn from different things, but are we taking? I don't know. You know, it was like a big question mark for me as I was reading it. I'm like, man, they really got scalded for, you know, something that they thought they were doing right.
So you didn't want to see that Portland pop-up close?
I didn't want to see them close. Like, it's more of a discussion that they should have had and we all should have had rather than forcing those girls to close, you know?
Rachel?
I mean, we all have open kitchen. I mean, like, if we have customers who are sitting in front of and just watching us how to cook and try to, like, you know, take it their own, like, I would feel honored. I'll never feel like someone's, you know, stealing my, you know, recipes. Right. Or
what if that patron is filming you with their phone? You're
people
okay with
that nowadays, they do actually.
I don't tell them, hey, stop that, you know? It's open kitchen.
They do Snapchatting entire time when you're cooking, kitchen. Too, sometimes.
Yeah, the thing, one thing about those girls, I don't think they got in the car and said, we're going to go down there to steal this recipe and bring it back. They were inspired and they got excited, you know? That's what I read, you know? I haven't talked to them personally, but
Right. Yeah,
I don't think they made it their mission.
That seems important, right? You're guessing as to whether the chef is inspired, is humble, is grateful. I mean, should I be trying to read the mind of the chef?
No, I mean, like, I know that's why it's really difficult, but at the same time, I think the whole thing about, you know, like, how do you, like, celebrate diversity in this country? I think that's what we're all trying to do. It's the looking at it from basically American perspective, like, oh, this country or, you know, this culture is not quite, you know, at the same level as American culture.
Wealthy, yeah.
And then I think that people are being very extra sensitive about, like, how do you appreciate their culture? How do you really take care of their culture or celebrate their culture? And I think that's where people, you know, though we're talking about the word fusion, even, you know, for me to use for my food is because that's what people had to label, because we are basically mixing Western flavor with Asian flavor. And then whenever it's done by Asian chef, it's always called fusion.
That's right. I've never heard of European fusion.
Like, we're not just taking, you know, things. We are here. And then, you know, I think that we talk about sometimes, like, you know, our food might be we authentically same as what you might have it over there. But, like, here, like, you know, if we have so many people who come to our restaurant and then had our, you know, spicy rice cake, and they're like, oh, my God, this is like... This is, you know, this Korean chili paste called gochujang. It's like, I've never heard of it before. What is it? Where can I get it? I want to buy one for home. I want to try it. And that just makes me really happy that, like, gosh, like, yes, I was not selling authentic Korean food, but this way they got to try it in their own way and then brought it to their house. And I think that makes me feel like, gosh, now they get to understand and celebrate in this kind of flavor.
Should I care where the owner or chef was born, what their skin color is? Are you saying I should be blind to all that, or should I pay attention?
I think you should care about eating good food. You know, Okay. That's the most important thing. That's the underlining thing that you're trying to do when you come to a restaurant. It's about restoring your soul and your body and giving you energy, and hopefully you had a good meal. And then also hopefully you're learning something and experiencing something different when you go into that restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the food in the restaurant is really, it's one of those most honest thing. Like, good food tastes good.
Right.
Bad food tastes bad, no matter what you do, like, no matter who
is.
You are.
Good. If it doesn't taste good, no. it doesn't taste good.
Seattle's Rachel Yang is chef and owner of Jewel, Revel, Trove, and Revelry. And Eduardo Jordan is chef and owner of Solari and June Baby restaurants in Seattle. And speaking of food and culture, we're about 3 weeks away from the annual Bite of Seattle at Seattle Center, where you can find sushi burritos, chicken waffle sliders, and something called tornado potato, which I just found out is a popular street food in South Korea. It's a deep-fried, spiral-cut potato on a skewer brushed with onion or cheese or honey, possibly with sausage, in between the slices of tornado potato. Happy lunch hour from KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. We're going to take a quick break and then back with one more story today. Okay, in 1972, a group of Mexican-American students at the University of Washington decided to form a dance troupe. They wanted to show non-Latinos the diversity of Mexican culture. 45 years later, the troupe they founded has become a touchstone for this region's growing Latino population. Here's KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman to tell you more.
It's a Wednesday evening, and this rehearsal room in the Seattle Center Armory is packed. Teenagers do homework. Babies are passed from lap to lap, and a group of dancers struggles through some complicated choreography. The group comes together three evenings a week to learn these dances. They're part of a cultural tradition called folklorico. The dancers come from all regions of Mexico.
I'm from Durango, and that's considered northern Mexico. Most of what we dance is polkas. We go to Leavenworth, and we almost feel like we can dance those.
That's Adrian Olivas. He's the director of this group, Bailadores de Bronce, Bronce for short. The group was formed by University of Washington students on the heels of the African-American civil rights movement.
There was no representation from Chicano because there wasn't very many Mexicans. And so they started that, trying to promote their culture and try to find an identity.
At the beginning, Bronce only had about 10 dancers, all students. The troupe has tripled in size and expanded its membership beyond the UW campus.
That's kind of one of the things that I'm proud of here, because it doesn't matter your background, it doesn't matter where you come from. We have doctors, we have chemists, we have students, we have horticulturists.
Olivas makes his living tending to plants. Bronce nurtures his soul, and he's not the only one.
In this group, we celebrate the Mexican culture, the music, the dance, the wardrobe.
Julian Perez is a family physician.
The first time that I actually was introduced to dancing, it was a youth conference, and there was a dance on Saturday night. They were all getting ready to go dance, and I didn't want to go because I was very shy and I didn't know how to dance. And there was one of the boys who was disabled, and he used canes, basically, like crutches to walk. And he told me, if I can dance, you can dance.
He's been dancing folklorico for more than two decades. Perez directed Bronce for several years, but he stepped away when his daughter was born. She's at this rehearsal with her dad, watching the dancers and stomping her feet to the lively music. Like Perez and Olivas, many Bronce members have been dancing for years, but you don't need any experience to join the group. Anthony Hernandez didn't know much about his Mexican heritage when a friend brought him to a rehearsal a year and a half ago. The 17-year-old high school student doesn't even speak Spanish. Hernandez says Bronce has transformed his life.
I don't believe I've gotten the full experience of this group, but what I have gotten is incredible, and it's completely changed the way I see a lot of things, and it's gotten me that connection to my culture that I haven't gotten for the rest of my life, essentially.
King County's Latino population has doubled over the past decade. Bronce artistic director Adrian Olivas says the dance troupe has become a place for Latinos to embrace who they are.
You know, a lot of kids, especially the ones that are born here, they sometimes can't find their way. They really don't identify themselves as Americans because they're seen as Mexicans, and they're not identified with the Mexicans because they seem as American. So this is kind of a bridge.
Dancer Julian Perez says that bridge between cultures is more important now than ever before.
We're well aware that these are very politically charged times, and we want to be a positive example for everybody on both sides of the aisle about the best of what Mexico has to offer.
At Seattle Center, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
European civilization is in the process of dying as a result of immigration. So argues author Douglas Murray. He'll tell you about his new book, The Strange Death of Europe, Immigration, Identity, Islam. That's coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered today. Also, why have thieves stolen thousands of beehives worth more than $1 million? That and more on All Things Considered coming up later this afternoon on KUOW.